on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump had asked Ukraine to respond to his peace plan by Thursday, but he's signaling that he may allow that deadline to slip. We'll have the latest. And we talked to an expert who says extra screen time for kids may not be as bad as you think. Plus, the evolution of kissing.
Primates in particular are extremely sociable. And so being able to kind of navigate any tricky social situations with a bit of a kiss could be really helpful.
It's Sunday, November 23rd. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report.
Everybody get their own baseline. Get manganese tested on your water.
Tracy, this is a point I should jump in.
People in the audience of an overflowing Emily City Council chambers last week occasionally interjected and applauded as members heard an update on a potential manganese mining operation. Councilmember Dan Brennan was the one who jumped in at this moment, directing questions to North Star Manganese CEO Rick Sandry. Sandry was at the meeting to share the latest updates on a project that's been on the table for at least 17 years. A third-party study of a possible mine, known as a preliminary economic assessment, shows that not only is it financially viable, but it could make back its investment in less than 2 years. There's a whole heap of steps that the company needs to undertake now. Sandry likened the report to them having graduated kindergarten. There's pre-feasibility reports and feasibility reports and environmental testing, not to mention a likely many years-long permitting process before a mine could open. But what the people of Emily want to know is, when are they going to test the drinking water? And is that water in danger of contamination if an underground mine were to be built? Brennan joined the council in 2024, but he's long been a part of the Emily Mine Information Group, a citizen organization conducting its own research. He says the group took on testing on its own when it became clear that promises weren't being kept by those involved in the exploration before North Star Manganese.
It seems to me that more can be being done to assess the impacts here as well as for you and your bottom line.
Well, that's where the next phase of our activity is to do that. Had we come up with a bad answer on a PEA, we would be telling everybody thank you very much for allowing us to participate up here, pick up our shoes, and go somewhere else to look for another project.
Some of the first exploratory drilling in Emily occurred decades ago in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Various drilling efforts by different mining companies, including in 2023 by North Star, gave insight into what was locked deep below the earth, billions of pounds of rich manganese ore. An accelerated push toward clean energy alternatives and a growing market for electric vehicles and other battery-powered technologies reignited interest in the site's potential. Manganese is one of the metals used in battery production, combined with nickel and cobalt to increase energy storage capacity. While the element is one of the most plentiful on the planet, a small sliver appears to be pure enough for battery use, and signs so far point to Emily's deposit containing that high-quality ore. If the mine moves forward, it would be the only such operation on the continent in a marketplace where most of the mining is happening in Africa and processing in China. The report predicts the mine lifespan would be at least 23 years, producing 400,000 tons of manganese annually. Mayor Tracy Jones asked Sandry to explain in the simplest terms possible what the benefits would be for Emily residents.
You know, 25 years of activity here that people will be buying from the ACE, going to local restaurants and things of that sort. So that kind of base.
He also pointed to cash payments per ton of material, a plethora of taxes levied by the state that benefit the local governments, and about 100 high-paying mining jobs. 30-year councilmember Gary Hansen, who described himself as among the skeptics, responded.
But Rick, you got to keep in mind, no amount of money replaces what we have here.
This is, and I fully support that.
Sandry said he views this project as his parting legacy in a long career, and it's important to him to get it right.
I'm an environmentalist that's in the mining industry. I believe that things need to be done correctly to be able to utilize the assets that God gave us on this planet. But I believe we should utilize the assets. So I come from that side of the use. And I don't want it to be my reputation or on my tombstone that I caused issues at Emily.
There's more to this story. Find photos and diagrams and more at KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump is pushing a peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. Initially, the president wanted a response from Kyiv by this Thursday, but now says the deadline could be extended if things are working well. And when asked by a reporter yesterday if this was his final offer to Ukraine, the president replied,
"No, not by much." No, we'd like to get to peace. It should have happened a long time ago. The Ukraine war with Russia should have never happened. If I were president, it never would have happened. We're trying to get it ended. One way or the other, we have to get it ended. So,
to discuss all this, we're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning, Aisha.
So, as the president himself admitted last week, ending this conflict has not been easy and is not easy. So, what do we know about this peace proposal, and what are the chances it could work?
Well, it's a 28-point plan, and it was crafted by the U.S. and the Kremlin without Ukraine's involvement. And so it is widely seen as very friendly to Russia. Under it, Ukraine would give up territory to Russia. It would cut the size of its military. And this plan says that Ukraine can never enter NATO. That's a big deal. Now, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has responded in stark terms. He said the choice here is a loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner, seeming to mean the U.S. So Ukraine doesn't like this plan, but Trump badly wants to be able to say he ended this conflict. And there was that clip you played. Trump said that this plan isn't his final offer. So maybe he'll be inclined to help reach a compromise.
We had a really dramatic announcement late on Friday night from Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. She was, until recently, one of the president's biggest supporters. But now she says she'll leave Congress in January. Are we seeing cracks in the MAGA coalition?
Yes, and this break is just stunning. I remember seeing her on the campaign trail open for Trump at a rally in Georgia. The Trump crowd went wild for her. This was a tight relationship. But we've seen this MAGA rift growing this year over U.S. ties to Israel, military involvement in Iran. There's just this feeling among some that Trump has softened on his isolationism. So there's ideology at work here, but then there's politics. Trump is 79 and also running again would be unconstitutional, no matter what he says. So Marjorie Taylor Greene may be looking ahead to the post-Trump GOP and staking out her territory. She's been saying lately that she's more America first than Trump. So if she pursued office again, that might appeal to MAGA people.
President Trump labeled Marjorie Taylor Greene a traitor after their public fallout. But she wasn't the only politician that he lashed out at, right?
No, not at all. Trump last week responded to a video made by Democratic lawmakers who are also veterans. And in that video, they told members of the military and intelligence communities, you can refuse illegal orders. Now, Trump went on social media and said that this is seditious behavior punishable by death, which is shocking and dark and upsetting. And it led to this surreal feeling moment in the press briefing last week, where a reporter asked if the president really wants to execute members of Congress. And Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said no. But both this episode and Trump's feud with Marjorie Taylor Greene resulted in real fear. Taylor Greene has talked about having increased threats, and Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin received a bomb threat.
And New York Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani had what I think many would call like a surprisingly cordial visit to the White House. Here's what the president had to say.
We agree on a lot more than I would have thought. I think he's, I want him to do a great job, and we'll help him do a great job.
What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's surprising, no doubt. You said it. Trump had attacked Mamdani a lot. He had even threatened at one point to arrest him. And of course, Mamdani had attacked Trump as well. But Mamdani did have a reason to make nice. Trump had threatened cutting federal funds to New York and also sending federal troops to the city. Now, Trump, you know, it's possible Mamdani just charmed him, but it's also possible Trump didn't want to lash out at a guy who's popular, has a winning populist message, and also, we all know Trump just likes a winner.
That's NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump campaigned on the idea of eliminating the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And in his first days in office, he created a review council to help determine FEMA's fate. That panel was supposed to issue a report last week, but missed the deadline. And lately, the administration has softened its tone on FEMA. Scott Dance is a climate reporter with the New York Times and joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
So you reported last week that Trump's panel actually disagrees with him on the idea of shutting down FEMA. What did you find out?
Yeah, I mean, this task force was created under the idea that President Trump was saying this agency needs to go away. It's bloated and inefficient in helping disaster survivors. It is rife for waste, fraud, and abuse, as the administration would say. And so they tasked these mostly leaders of emergency management agencies in cities and states, in states like Florida and Texas that receive a lot of disaster aid. And they spent this time studying and you know, taking in 13,000 comments from the public. And they have decided, actually, FEMA needs to be somewhat elevated in its role and report directly to the president as a cabinet-level agency instead of being part of the Department of Homeland Security.
So that's the opposite of wanting to get rid of it. Is this in line with the idea that there is something of a consensus that FEMA could be improved? Like, and not just Republicans think that. Is that what they kind of found?
Yes, I mean, it's even back to previous administrations, there among Democrats and Republicans, there is an understanding that FEMA is unwieldy at times when disaster strikes. It can take years, if not decades, to help communities fully recover from storms and other disasters. So there's wide agreement that something needs to change with FEMA to help get money to communities faster. We're seeing, obviously, more disasters, more damage because of development patterns and building codes and things like that. So, there's a recognition now among Republicans who, of course, are controlling Washington that this is an important role that the government plays, and it's very difficult for people facing rebuilding and communities that have lost, you know, or had damage to infrastructure to find a new way to pay for that if the federal government, you know, if FEMA were to go away. And so that's not really realistic.
And is that why? Because Trump, obviously, he has, you know, worked to get rid of the Department of Education, USAID. I mean, he's really been dismantling parts of the federal government. But it sounds like what this council found and what maybe the White House is finding is that FEMA is much more difficult to try to get rid of.
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of kind of constituencies that really rely on it. The system in which we respond to these disasters is still really built around FEMA. So, you know, they're talking about different ways of getting money more quickly to communities through grants or things like that. But yeah, there is a sense that we need FEMA.
And so do we know what the holdup is for? What is your reporting saying about why they are holding up the report right now?
Yeah, so there is a disagreement between the members of the task force and Kristi Noem, who is the Homeland Security Secretary, and she's also the chairwoman of this task force. So, you know, they had sent a report to her that was lengthy, and she has edited it down. The administration says she has not altered the contents of the report at all. But what we're hearing is there is a disagreement over that idea that FEMA should be a cabinet-level agency, that it should, you know, be somewhat elevated in its role, whereas Kristi Noem, you know, wants to leave it as part of the Department of Homeland Security and, continue this idea that it should be diminished or really rethought in a dramatic way.
We reached out to FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security for comment, and a spokesperson referred us to comments by the vice chair of the Review Council, former Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant, and he says editing and revising the draft report is a normal part of the process and, quote, does not signal disagreement or conflict. How does that square with your reporting?
I think it's certainly fair to say, yes, she Kristi Noem is the chairwoman, and you know, right. It makes sense that whatever they decide would need to be squared with her and what she thinks the future of FEMA should be. So, I think we've definitely heard that there is disagreement, makes sense that they're going to need to work this out and form a coalition that agrees on what the future of FEMA should look like.
That's Scott Dance of the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Something to be thankful for this holiday season. Your Thanksgiving meal may be just a little bit cheaper. The price of turkeys, cranberries, and ingredients for pies and stuffing are all lower than last year. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, NPR's Scott Horsley heads to the supermarket to find out how shoppers are feeling. Tune in by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. You're listening to NPR News.
And you are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, November 24th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our board of directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned. Stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. There's a health fair at the Itasca County Family YMCA in Grand Rapids tomorrow from 2 to 5. Several free screenings will be offered, including bone density and glucose testing. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on KAXE-KBXE.
With these headlines, the White House is accusing South Africa of weaponizing its presidency of the Group of 20. Member countries this weekend adopted a climate declaration over U.S. objections. South Africa says the document can't be renegotiated. The U.S. had boycotted this year's summit. Israel carried out new airstrikes against Hamas in Gaza this weekend. Health officials say at least 24 people were killed in the attacks. Israel says it launched the strikes after an armed terrorist shot at Israeli troops. A shelter-in-place order has been lifted for neighborhoods near the Port of Los Angeles. A fire broke out on a container ship that was carrying hazardous materials. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Some of you may remember this New York public service announcement that ran from the 1960s to the 90s.
It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
The PSA was meant to remind parents to make sure their kids were home and safe. Today, children in the U.S. are highly supervised in physical spaces, but not as strictly online. To understand the consequences of that, we're joined by Eli Stark Elster. He studies the evolution of human society at UC Davis. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
For years, kids played unsupervised outdoors and spent a lot of time together without adults. What changed?
When you look at the record of childhood across human societies, you find that kids are generally afforded a really high degree of independence and autonomy. They spend much of their time in independent peer cultures. And in the early 1970s or so, the ability for kids to develop these kinds of independent peer cultures drops really precipitously, and that has not changed to the present day. I think one big factor underlying this shift is the urbanization of the United States. It is arguably just a little less safe for kids to roam around due to traffic concerns. Often kids are just not all that close to other kids physically. Another, I think, underlying concern here is just the fear of stranger danger.
In the physical space, there's a lot more supervision, but that hasn't translated to a lot of supervision in the digital space?
Yes, yeah, that's correct. This is a very recent innovation, and so we understand very little about how these kinds of environments actually work and how they're affecting our children. We often emphasize what technology is doing to our children. But I think when you look at the trend in human evolution and this desire kids clearly have to build their, you know, sort of secret worlds away from us, the picture that arises is kids are using digital space as sort of the last frontier to get away from us.
Well, how important is it for kids to have those adult-free zones?
Immensely important. And we see a very stark trend that different measures of mental health among children begin to decline at around the same time that their autonomy becomes more and more restricted. There's a study conducted by UNICEF every few years where they track independent mobility in different countries, the amount of freedom kids have to move from place to place by themselves against measures of well-being. And you see a very clear trend that greater mobility leads to greater well-being and vice versa.
The kids in my house, my kids, are constantly like online playing Roblox with each other, playing, you know, Minecraft and other games, but they're playing together. Talk to me about that.
I think one contrast that is maybe useful is between two games, both of which kids love. One is Minecraft and the other is Fortnite. When you look at the way that these games are built, I think there are very different reasons that kids are drawn to them. One of those reasons is good and the other one is probably bad. In the case of Fortnite, the company that designs the game has essentially built it like a casino. It is designed to draw kids in, hook their attention, and keep them in these repetitive loops that encourage them to eventually spend lots of money on the game. Minecraft is not built that way. It's a one-time purchase. And I think they love it for a different reason than Fortnite, which is that it's a very open-ended exploratory game where you can collaborate with your friends and they have pretty much total control over what they choose to do. So when you sort of zoom out, it can look like these are two instances of a similar thing of kids addicted to video games. But when you zoom in on what they're actually doing and how those games are built, you get a very different picture, I think, of what's actually happening in those worlds. The key thing to look for here when kids are playing or in a physical or a virtual space is, do they have the freedom to make their own decisions in this space? Are they exploring? Are they spending time with other kids? If the answer to all those questions is yes, my sense is that the play is probably just as good, regardless of the domain.
So how should parents be thinking about how much time kids spend in the digital space?
The key question that parents should probably ask is, are my kids getting space to be independent from me, to spend time with their friends unsupervised, and to explore in ways that they're determining on their own?
ultimately, I guess, how do you keep your kids safe?
I think perspective here is a trade-off between short-term safety and long-term ability to flourish as an adult. So just as an example, a colleague of mine mentioned this recently. He's at a park with his five-year-old son, and his five-year-old son had a little toy truck. Some other kid came and pulled it away. His son and this other kid started fighting. Now, in the long term, it would actually probably be really good for his son and this other kid to just figure out this conflict themselves, right? But he and the other parent both jump in and resolve it. And they're doing that because in the short term, they want to keep their kids safe. They want to make sure no one gets hit and so on. In the long term, though, that might not be such a good thing for the safety. And so when we think about the safety of our kids, the real question is, what is going to help them flourish as adults? And in many cases, the measures that we think we're taking to make them safer in the short term are probably harmful in the long term.
That's Eli Stark Elster. He studies the evolution of human society at UC Davis. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The fate of Ukraine could be determined in the coming days. Talks are currently underway on a U.S. proposed peace plan to end Russia's invasion of the country. But for the nearly million Ukrainian soldiers, there's no respite. Not yet. Most of them are men, but women are increasingly playing a visible role. They're enlisting in growing numbers, fighting on the front lines, and sometimes paying the ultimate price. NPR's Ukraine correspondent Joanna Kakissis has been speaking to several of these women. Her story begins in the Ukrainian capital, and a warning, this report contains the sounds of gunfire.
The firing range outside Kyiv is where 27-year-old Marina Mitsyuk spends her free time. She wears fatigues and focuses on hitting her targets. She is joining Ukraine's military, and she's waiting for the call that will send her to war. Of course, I'd like to be in a combat position, she says. With my build and height, I'm not a natural fit for that, so I'm training very hard. At a cafe, Mitsyuk tells me about her life before the war. She studied folklore and Japanese at university. Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022 changed her plans. I realized then, she says, that sooner or later, every one of us will end up in the military. So in 2023, she enrolled at Ukraine's National Defense University. She graduated this summer and can now serve as an officer and lead platoons. She says, now brigades are offering me positions and asking me, are you ready to live with 40 men and command them? She smiles because here's the thing. Men between the ages of 25 and 60 can be drafted in Ukraine, but women are exempt. Mitsyuk is choosing to fight, and she is not alone. Ukraine's military has a gender advisor, Oksana Grigorieva, and she says women comprise about 8% of Ukraine's armed forces, but that their numbers have increased 40% since 2021. She says, until a 2018 law, the military was very patriarchal and women were not legally allowed to serve in combat positions or study all disciplines at military universities. Today, Grigorieva says, a fifth of military cadets are women and thousands more serve in frontline roles, including infantry, drone operators, medics, and engineers. Some of Ukraine's top military brigades also feature women in recruiting campaigns. The Khartia Brigade is part of Ukraine's National Guard and an innovator in robotic warfare. This recruitment video shows a red-haired woman named Jess with a ribbon in her hair testing land drones. I am the only woman in this unit, Jess says. I am 21 years old.
Hi.
Yevhenia and Dasha join Khartia in 2024. They navigate aerial drones used for reconnaissance. We met them early this year at a hut used for drone repair in northeastern Ukraine. At the request of Ukraine's military, NPR is identifying some of the soldiers by their first names or military call signs. Yevhenia and Dasha wear puffy coats and sit on rickety stools next to a 3D printer that spits out drone parts. Yevhenia is 19 and she looks a lot like Arya Stark from Game of Thrones. She says male soldiers always ask her, what are you doing here?
And what do you say? Я відповідаю, що я маю тут бути, і все.
She says, I tell them I have to be here, and that's that.
А чому дрони?
And why drones, she adds? I don't know, because I love to play computer games.
Ми чекаємо наказів.
Next to her is Dasha, who is 23, tall and stern. She was briefly married and wanted to be a police officer. She says her mother wept when she left for basic training.
Мама думає, що мені потрібно сидіти.
Dasha says, my mother wanted me to stay at home, be a wife, have children. And I chose what she calls a man's profession, something that will put my life at risk. Another drone operator in the unit, her name is Daria, is in a muddy field a short drive away. Daria is in her early 30s and used to be a software developer. As the sun sets, she tests a new aerial drone. She brings up her family.
They can say she need to go to Europe and be in some safe place. And it's very strange in my mind that I'm speaking now with you.
Because most of her relatives, she says, don't even know she is here, that she's a soldier. Meanwhile, she says, male friends have fled the country to avoid the draft. She struggles not to judge them.
Like, it's their choice. They can do what they want to do. I can say everybody need to do like me.
Although, she adds, that's what she really wants to say. About 100 miles north in the city of Sumy, we met combat medic Olena Ivanenko, who was then serving in the 47th Brigade. She uses the call sign Ridge. She's gone straight from the front line into a beauty salon. A nail master gently chisels at her manicure.
Я знаю, що через 3 дні мені нігті будуть знову чорні.
She says, I know that in 3 days my nails will be grimy again, but looking at clean nails for just one day gives me such relief and pleasure. Ridge is 44. She's high energy with fuchsia-tinted hair. She worked in the restaurant industry for 20 years before enlisting in 2023, serving first as an infantry soldier. She says, I decided after 3 months of service that I would stay in the Army forever. I will not return to civilian life. I feel like I am 100,000,000% in my place. Her service, though, has also brought her heartbreak. She chokes up when she recalls the 2023 battle in southeastern Ukraine, where many in her unit died, including one of her closest friends. He was the first to get blown up, she says, and I pulled him out of the dugout. This is probably the hardest thing for me in this whole war so far. Ridge says she sees the divide between soldiers and civilians growing. Soldiers say we are working for victory, and civilians say we want peace, she says. But peace and victory are different things. Ukraine's military does not release casualty figures, but nearly every day there is a funeral for a soldier. In September, a large crowd filled Kyiv's main cathedral to mourn one. The family clutched a framed portrait showing a smiling young woman with wire-rimmed glasses. Daria Lopatina, a military engineer. She was 19. Saluting her coffin was Ruslan Shalar, who works at the Defense Ministry. He says Lopatina was just 8 years old in 2014 when Russia first invaded Ukraine's east and south. She grew up with war, he says, surrounded by people who had taken part in it. Her path was set. Marina Mitsiuk, the new recruit we met at the beginning of this report, acknowledges that joining the military is a high-stakes path. She looks around at the lively cafe that's part of her civilian life, and she looks me straight in the eye. She says, you know, I constantly think about it, about death. But it's better to die on the battlefield than from a missile hitting your apartment in Kyiv. It's better to die fighting than on your knees. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, reporting from Kyiv and northeastern Ukraine.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Americans may be watching how much they're spending these days, given how the cost of goods and services have gone up. But that seems not to be true when it comes to Bible sales. This is curious, given how frequently we hear that Americans are not as religious now as they've been in the past. What's going on with this Bible boom? Joining me now is national reporter Bob Smetana of Religion News Service. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Can you give us some numbers? What does this Bible boom look like?
Sure. So far this year, about 18 million Bibles have been sold, which is about 11% up from last year. What's interesting is last year, sales were up 20% from the year before. So for the last 4 or 5 years, we've been in kind of a Bible selling boom. And kind of one reason is that there are just a lot of different kinds of Bibles to buy.
Is it then maybe not that more people are buying Bibles, just that people are buying more than one version of the Bible?
That I don't know. I know that there are a lot of different kind of Bibles being sold. That's the one thing I do know. So there could be both things going on. One of the things I did while working on this story was just call up a Bible seller. What are you seeing? And she told me a couple things. One is she's got some folks who are younger, maybe in their 30s and 40s. They dropped out of church. Now they're starting to go back and they need a Bible, right? One woman said, hey, Charlie Kirk just died and I want to go back to church. But then there's other older folks who are buying for their kids or they're buying for their grandkids. So this is kind of whole range of all kinds of different people buying Bibles.
What are some of the most popular versions of the Bible right now?
The best selling is the paperback version of the English Standard Version. You get it for about $6 and people buy it in bulk at churches. Another one that's really popular is called She Reads Truth. It's part of a Bible study for women. There's a great Bible called the Grace Bible for Kids. It's a Bible that is for kids with dyslexia. It's really different colored and has different kind of print. Parts of the font make it easier for kids with dyslexia to read. And that thing sold so many they couldn't keep it on the shelves.
There's so many different translations of the Bible. Do you think that plays into this?
So one thing about the Bible is this. It's written in Hebrew and Greek. So you translate that into English. Well, English changes all the time, right? Words mean different things. So you can have a word-for-word translation that doesn't get the thoughts in mind. So there's translations that are word-for-word. There's some that are thought-for-thought. There's some that are paraphrases. And then the Bible is complicated, right? It's 2,000 or 3,000 years old. You hear some king's name. You hear them putting on sackcloth and ashes or whatever they're doing. And you think, I don't know what's going on. And so sometimes there'll be notes. But also an easier translation can make you understand, oh, that's what they mean.
This Bible boom, it's coming at a time when organized religion is declining. Are people maybe reading or studying on their own? Like, what might this bit of sales data tell us about how religious Americans are, at least in regards to Christianity?
So one thing we know is that people aren't part of a house of worship, or they don't identify a particular religion. They're still spiritual. So you could have some folks who are reading on their own and not going to a church service. You also could have people who are just anxious. We have had war, political polarization. We have everything going on, immigration. There's a lot of tension. So people might be looking for kind of peace and answers.
That's Bob Smetana, national reporter for Religion News Service. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now might be the right time to give to KAXE and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps People Powered Radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXE. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. Minnesota State Parks offer free admission on Friday, November 28th. Get out and explore your favorite park or find somewhere new. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. A bipartisan group of senators is criticizing President Trump's plan to end the war in Ukraine. Lawmakers say Secretary of State Marco Rubio told them Kyiv is being pressured toward Moscow's terms, calling it a Russian wish list. A federal appeals court has issued a ruling keeping limits on fast-track deportations in place. A judge refused to lift a block on expanding expedited removals inside the United States. A UN climate conference ended without a fossil fuel deal. COP30 wrapped up in Brazil on Saturday with no agreement to phase out oil, gas, or coal. The U.S. skipped the talks after the Trump administration refused to send a delegation. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at WallaceFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
Excellent. How are you, Aisha?
I am good. So, Will, please remind us of last week's challenge.
Yeah, it was a tough one from Dave Shukin of San Marino, California. I said, take the name of a famous person in American politics, six-letter first name, six-letter last name. And I said, hidden in this name, reading from left to right, but not in consecutive letters, is the name of a well-known place that's very dry in four letters. Remove these letters, and the remaining eight letters in order will spell another well-known, very dry place. I asked, what politician is this? Well, it is Kamala Harris. Reading left to right in that string of letters is Mars, M-A-R-S, which, of course, is very dry. Drop those four letters, and you're left with the Kalahari, as in the desert.
There were just 589 correct entries, and this week's winner is Dennis Pattinson of Cincinnati, Ohio. Congratulations, Dennis.
Thank you.
Okay, so how did you figure this out?
Well, the first hint was the person had six letters in the first name and six in the last. So there's only a few politicians that met that criteria. Stacey Abrams, Maxine Waters, Thomas Massey, and Kamala Harris. So once I had the names, it was a matter of figuring out what the correct words were. Mars came to me with Kamala, and then Kalahari spelled itself out.
Oh, my goodness. So how long have you been playing the puzzle?
I remember sending in postcards years ago.
But you've never won before.
I have never won. I'm excited.
Well, I'm glad it has finally come through for you. What do you do when you're not playing the puzzle?
I am retired. What I tell myself is I get paid to go shopping. I go and buy things at flea markets and thrift stores and yard sales, and then I turn a couple things and put them on eBay.
Oh, that sounds fun. So what's your favorite thing to turn around and resell?
I am a jigsaw puzzle fan.
Oh,
so
okay.
I will buy the classic vintage jigsaw puzzles, make sure they have all the pieces, and then put them on eBay.
That tells me that you are a puzzler. You love puzzles. But I gotta ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I am ready.
All right, take it away, Will.
Okay, Dennis, this is a phonetic puzzle, and it's a pretty tough one. I'm going to read you some sentences. Each sentence contains homophones of two opposites. For example, if I said people in Albany enunciate well, you would say all and none, because those are hidden inside Albany and enunciate. And I'll tell you, the homophones can be buried inside words, but they're always discrete syllables, and they always change spelling from their parts in the sentence. So here's number one. The model wore a timepiece on her ankle.
War and peace.
Good job. Who will underwrite the cost of the sarong? Here, I'll read it again.
Right and wrong. Right and wrong.
You didn't need me to repeat. This is a rare Bolivian diamond.
Oh, I think I got this one.
Aisha, I'll take your help.
I think focus on Bolivian and diamond?
Yes.
Bowl.
No, try the second syllable.
Live and die. Okay, live and die. There it is.
Good job.
Wow.
The customer got a souvenir from a pharmacy.
Near and far.
You got it. Let's celebrate by throwing a party.
So throw?
No. Let's celebrate by throwing a party.
Oh, okay. So.
Oh, sell and.
Yes.
Buy. Sell and buy.
That's it. Good one.
Ooh. Yeah, that's tough.
The stoker must reignite the furnace daily. Here it is again. The stoker must reignite the furnace daily.
Night.
Yes.
And day.
Night and day is it. And here's your last one. Can buffalo experience hypertension? Can buffalo experience hypertension?
Low and high.
You got it. You survived.
You did a wonderful job, Dennis, because that was a tough one. How do you feel?
I feel great.
Okay. For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Dennis, what member station do you listen to?
WVXU.
That's Dennis Pattinson of Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thank you.
All right, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, fortunately, it's a little easier than that last one. It comes from Greg Van Mechelen of Berkeley, California. Name some equipment an equestrian might use. Remove the second, third, and fourth letters and reverse those that remain, and the result will name some more equipment that an equestrian might use. What things are these? So again, some equipment an equestrian might use. Remove the second, third, and fourth letters, reverse what's left, and the result will spell some more equipment that an equestrian might use. What things are these?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle. To submit your response, just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Wednesday, November 26th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shorts. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
Folks, if you can, get out a pen and paper, because we're about to talk about some of our favorite books of the year, and you might want to jot a few of these titles down. With us to talk about NPR's annual interactive books roundup, Books We Love, is Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Aisha.
We love this time of year, but for listeners who aren't familiar, tell them about Books We Love.
It is not just like a best of, here's the 10 best books you gotta read in 2025, right? We ask everyone at NPR, so we got editors and producers and people on the business side and all that stuff. We ask them what their favorite books of the year were. This year, we're in the neighborhood of 380 books, which is a lot, but the size and scope is sort of the whole point.
So what have you got for us?
All right, well, word on the street, I hear that someone on your staff is looking for something plotty.
Okay.
So one of the books I personally recommended was Emma Petit's Tilt. Now, this is a book about a woman. She's super duper pregnant, and she's at an IKEA running an errand when an earthquake happens. And it's a really speedy book because at its core, it is a very person has to go from point A to point B, right? She's got to find her way home out of this IKEA in a Portland that has been ravaged by an earthquake. And she runs into a few obstacles here and there, and she sort of has to be on the move. But what it is also is a critique or a pretty funny send-up of the keeping up with the Joneses of parenthood, right? Mm. You know, that feeling where if you don't buy the fanciest, schmanciest bajillion-dollar stroller, you are a failure.
Yeah.
It's sort of poking at that and asking some interesting questions about motherhood and marriage and relationships, all while being straight up an action adventure book. Another sort of plotty book is Kashana Cawley's The Payback. This is a bit of a heist novel about a woman and her friends who concoct a bit of an Ocean's 11 type caper to wipe out everyone's student loans. This isn't necessarily taking place in our world. It's in a bit of a heightened world where there are these special cops on the hunt for anyone who is late to repay their debts, and they will track you down and kind of assault you if you are late on your repayment. It's a pretty thrilling read.
Okay. Well, what about nonfiction?
Yeah, I know we're at the time of year where a lot of families are traveling, right? And traveling can be stressful. So a book I've been thinking about is called A Marriage at Sea by Sophie Elmhurst, right? It's about a young British couple in the 70s who decide they want to sell everything off and sail to New Zealand. Things don't go great. And they end up floating on a life raft in the Pacific. It's a deeply reported book, but it does also make me think like, oh, maybe me dragging my partner to the airport and the plane is delayed. Things could be worse than having to eat stale McDonald's fries. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
While we're talking about nonfiction, there's also this book called Fetishized by Kayla Yu. And this is a essay collection about having mixed feelings about being objectified. She was a former model, and so she cops to catering for what we might call the male gaze, but she is also aware of the broader political, cultural baggage that doing that can have. And so I think it's an interesting insight into a weird slice of life.
So what's a book that you recommend personally?
One of the books I put up for Books We Love was called The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz. This was actually one of the finalists for the Booker Prize. It's about a guy whose wife cheated on him a while back, but he swore not to do anything about it until they became empty nesters, right? Until their youngest was off in college. And so the book follows him dropping his daughter off at school and then going on a road trip. He doesn't have a destination in mind. He just is sort of driving to drive and to figure things out. I was a bit trepidatious about this novel. I thought it would be... people in books discourse have been thinking a lot about men, right? Men in books and men in literature. And I thought it was going to be a very like, here's the answers about all the problems plaguing men kind of book. But it's actually this really quiet and sweet and intimate book about a guy just trying to find some roots in some of the people he's sort of lost touch with.
That's NPR's Andrew Limbong. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks, Aisha.
And Books We Love publishes tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Eastern. You can find it online at npr.org/bestbooks. You got to get in the mood for this next story. It's all about kissing. Smooching goes way back. 21 million years, in fact. That's according to new research carried out about the origins of kissing. Matilda Brindle is an evolutionary biologist from Oxford University and was the lead researcher of the study. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Why research kissing?
I'm really interested in the evolution of behaviors, and especially those ones that might seem counterintuitive from an evolutionary perspective. So kissing doesn't seem like it's going to save your life. It might not necessarily be kind of important for survival. And it also doesn't look like it's directly important for reproducing. Animals can reproduce without kissing. So what we were interested in is why this behavior has evolved in the first place.
And you've got a very specific definition of a kiss, and it doesn't sound too romantic.
No, it is not the most romantic definition ever. So we define kissing as a non-agonistic interaction involving directed, intraspecific, oral-oral contact with some movement of the lips or mouth parts and no food transfer. So, I mean, just totally unromantic. A non-agonistic interaction just means that it's not an aggressive interaction. The reason we included that is that some fish will basically fight each other with their mouths wide open and press their mouths into each other. The intraspecific bit just means that it has to occur between the same species. So seems really obvious, but actually we know from experience that sometimes different species of animal will try and kiss each other. I'm afraid I've been on the receiving end of an attempted snog by a capuchin monkey, which, yeah, you know, occupational hazard. Yes. But we wanted to avoid that.
Yeah.
And then the reason we said that it couldn't include food transfer is, again, there's this behavior called pre-mastication, which is basically where mothers will kind of pre-chew food.
Yeah.
So it's easier to digest and swallow for their offspring. And then sometimes they'll pass that mouth to mouth.
So how do you know, though, that kissing evolved 21 million years ago?
We ran what's called an evolutionary simulation. What we did was take data on observations of kissing across living species. So we know that most of the large apes kiss, for example. What we also added to that was information on the evolutionary relationships between different species of primate. So when you have those two pieces of information, you can track back across the course of evolution and infer how a trait, in this case kissing, could have evolved. We found that the ancestor of all of the large apes, so that's humans, chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, and gorillas, was kissing 21.5 million years ago.
Do we know what's the point of kissing?
We weren't able to test this, unfortunately, but there are some hypotheses for why kissing might have evolved. So for sexual kissing, we think it might be something to do with mate assessment. Basically, before you get to the stage where you're investing in reproducing with another individual, having a little bit of a kiss could be a way of testing the waters and seeing
and
if they're worth
it. Testing the vibes.
Exactly.
If the vibing is right. Okay.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a vibe check. But also you're checking that they're healthy, you know.
Yes.
If they smell a bit ill, you might want to swerve away. And then the other idea is that it could be basically a type of foreplay. So individuals are becoming aroused before copulating, and that can actually increase the chance of fertilization during copulation. For non-sexual kissing, so platonic kissing, like for example, between a mother and offspring or between friends, we think that's to do with bonding. Obviously really important for mothers and offspring to bond, but there are other ways that kissing could be useful in a kind of friendly way too. Primates in particular are extremely sociable, and so being able to kind of navigate any tricky social situations with a bit of a kiss could be really helpful.
That's Matilda Brindle from Oxford University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com, member FDIC. The Arrowhead Library System presents Songs of Mesabi, a musical journey through the Iron Range with Greg Tiburzi, now through December 10th. Find a list of dates, times, and locations at ALSLIB.info. Lights in the Pines is a drive-through holiday light display at the Itasca County Fairgrounds in Grand Rapids. Hours are 5 to 8 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays between Thanksgiving and Christmas. After seeing the lights, you may park and explore North Pole Junction inside the commercial building. The Salvation Army in Hibbing has a free Thanksgiving meal on Wednesday, November 26 from 4 to 6. The event also features games,